you start talking about something, you go, wait, this, you don't have the context for this. I need another 50 minutes of talking to you about how this blueberry jam is made and why it's important. Welcome to Worldcasting, where we discuss real made-up things. I'm your host, Dino, and today you'll be joining me in a discussion on ways to approach conversations about our world building. As well, we will discuss the innate problem of over-explaining and ways to avoid it or to utilize it. Today joining me are Adam and Amakinate. If you'd be so kind as to introduce yourselves.
Hey, my name's Adam. We remember from last time, but editor-in-chief of Worldbuilding Magazine and a whole host of other stuff.
Hello. I am Imakinate, also known as Ianara, as I am credited as the editorial chair here at Worldbuilding Magazine. I'm an avid video gamer, tabletop gamer, and as you may guess it, a world builder. Glad to be here.
Thank you both for coming and joining me. I think we'll get started today with just a quick discussion on what we've all been up to with projects and the like. Adam, what have you been up to the past couple of weeks?
So I haven't been able to work on much lately. I took the week and went to go visit a friend of mine. So today was the drive back, just got back a couple hours ago here. So I spent about 4.5 hours on the road, I think. It's been a long day. But one thing I wanted to chat about during this was I live in a very rural area, and I had to go through even more rural areas to get back home. And aside from the snowplows and the what might have been some sort of oil truck, I'm not really sure what that one was, there were, I think, three or four different times I had to pass a Amish buggy, which kind of got me thinking about my world building and how I haven't explored any groups of people who might be kind of like how the Amish, and this is limited knowledge of the Amish here, so I might be getting some things wrong, but to my knowledge, they kind of reject modern technology and everything. And like, there are certain rules that they have about using it, owning it, etc. So it kind of got me thinking, it's like, well, my world has magic. My world has technology that's emerging. It's kind of like a 1900s sort of thing. So naturally, it would make sense that there's some people who might be rejecting advances in technology, might be rejecting new opinions about magic, which are also becoming more favorable, as opposed to historically in my world, magic was very much looked down on. So on the last like hour of my drive, I was just kind of like talking aloud to myself in the car and trying to come up with these alternate sects, which may not be super numerous, but maybe they have some influence and there's some divisions within them. So yeah, I just kind of wanted to share that because I basically never hear people talk about the Amish of their world. And I think it's a really interesting thing to explore, even if it's just a little bit of research and this thing on the side that you do.
That is an interesting thing to try to add into your setting. Some people who are either techno or mago deterrent people, that they don't use it and they try to stay away from it and live lives clean of it. Yeah, that is, and especially in a setting where you have this like turn of the 20th century technology level, That's really cool.
I can't understand why people wouldn't necessarily put that up first, though, because you want to have an established kind of bar for then why would these people be, or what would these people be rejecting? So you kind of need something beforehand for that part to make sense. Unless, of course, it's like presented as the initial conflict or a major conflict, then I guess that's what really turns the head initially.
I feel like if it'd be a main point of contention in your setting, it wouldn't necessarily be an Amish or like techno deterrent. It'd be more like being a Luddite and trying to counteract it actively. If it was to be a main showcase piece of the setting, it'd be more active force instead of one just living in it.
I think it depends on how you would intend to use it. For my purposes right now, it's not something that I'm really intending to use a lot in the stuff that I'm writing, but it's something that I kind of would like to have in the back of my pocket in case, you know, something lines up and it makes sense to use. I also think it just kind of makes the world feel more whole, where you have these differing opinions on the same topic, as opposed to right now, there's a history to things and things are moving forward. And that's kind of the end of the story. There's stuff, you know, you move on from there. But, you know, if I start adding these groups that, you know, are rejecting or actively trying to remove these advances for whatever reason, you know, give them a good cause that they all believe in, I think that can really make the world feel more realistic because people aren't just in agreement on magic or whatever the case may be.
I agree. I like nuance.
Most people do. But I mean, it takes a fine hand to make it, which is probably the best part about it, is that it's the culmination of so much effort, and it allows for this, like, not vague, but like this mirage view of things where you're not quite sure of it, but it's still there for at least a moment. But anyways, what about you, Amakinate? What have you been up to?
Oh, gosh. Well, I ate a pizza before we started recording. More seriously, I've been thinking of, I'm currently running one campaign, but I've been thinking of trying to do a second West Marches style campaign, and I really want to do it within my setting, but also not in the same area. So I've been thinking of ways to kind of mesh genres within world building, similar to a previous podcast we've recorded, just combining different sort of genres, like putting in fantasy with steampunk, with adventure, and a bit more, what's the best way to put it?
Panache, swashbuckling.
Yes, swashbuckling, all of that. But also changing up the overall kind of historical source and themes of the setting that it would take place in. Because I happen to be a Western history lover. Most of my settings have been based off European history, American history, North American history, rather. In this time, I kind of want to head back further towards Asian history and African history, just because it's something I haven't really done before. And it's these are regions I want to do a bit more research in, just for general knowledge as well.
That's really cool. Yeah, I mean, I'm not super big in the RPG scene myself. I the most I hear about it is honestly from you and some of the folks here. I know that the kind of Eastern and African scene is not super well represented in RPGs. So yeah, I'd love to see what you come up with for that world.
I need to write a lot more down, but I have the skeleton at this point, because I did think of this other side of the world before I started running my campaign, is that I have this massive European-based continent, or European-based supercontinent, but what else lies elsewhere? I didn't imagine my entire world would be homogenous as far as cultural roots, rather, based in our real world. So that's where I was kind of moving towards. But yeah, I look forward to brainstorming and really eating another pizza before I get into world building the whole shebang.
Nice. How about you, Dana? What's up with your stuff?
Well, I do run two campaigns and don't really do much to prepare for them. But this week I've had to try and do some prep work for both of them. I have things coming on for those. And one of them, I actually have some serious amount of lore to write, because I did not expect a player to play a snake person, because I therein had made essentially no lore about them other than small little sentences scattered across like 20 different documents.
Is one of those sentences, they are snake people?
Yes, actually. So I have to actually sit down and compile all the ideas I have for the serpents in my setting and compile it. And when one big thing gets made in my setting, it means that there's several other big things getting made. So it's just an arduous journey.
Yeah, I've seen some of your lore documents. I understand.
But that's what I've been up to.
Nice.
I remember removing Lizard Focus Erase that was playable just because I didn't feel like dealing with the world building of it in my homebrew setting. I know people might hate me if a player wanted to do it, but I did not like them. And I felt like they didn't need to exist in my world. So I was like, no.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, if you want continuity within what you're creating. So if it doesn't fit, then it doesn't fit.
And like playing a Pathfinder for me, like there's dozens, if not more, races. And it's like, not all of these are obviously playable, and I don't have lore for some of these things. Like there's this massive four-armed monstrosity that's like kind of a space T-Rex, and it's like, that's an alien. Get out of here.
You gave a T-Rex four arms?
No, that's an actual Pathfinder race. It's like the Trox or something like that.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, like, why are you giving a T-Rex with like the tiny little baby arms two more of those? Like, it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. But yeah, sometimes I like having a little bit too much of stuff, and it's a constant problem. So I rarely say no to some things and try to fit everything in. And the longer it goes on, the more I play in it. It just comes to the point where it's like, I'm trying to like shove stuff into a box that has no more room.
Yeah, I can feel that.
All right. So how about we get started on with today's topic? First up, we're just going to quickly frame this conversation about conversations of world building with the ways that you present your world building. And I don't mean like medium, like a book. I mean the physical tools you use, such as physical notes, mood boards, online programs such as OneNote, G Drive, Word, like websites like World Anvil, Legend Keeper, Campfire, and even then displaying maps of your setting with tools such as WonderDraft, Incarnate, GIMP, Photoshop, etc. So to start this off, Adam, what do you use to record your world building?
I'm pretty basic in this regard. I'm familiar with sites like World Anvil and Campfire, a little bit less with Legend Keeper, but I know there's a whole bunch of these kind of wiki-style tools to share your world and your information, slap on some pretty pictures, you know, really make it look nice. But I have this problem with presenting something before it's done, and nothing that I've written is done, because it keeps gradually expanding. My world document, which is just on Google Drive and a word processor, that's up to like 70 pages now, I think, and there's a whole bunch of blank spots where I just haven't been able to spend the time to really delve into a world. I was thinking today on the drive about kind of utilizing, I've got InDesign and Affinity Publisher, and those sound like a really good tool to like kind of create a brief guide to the world as told from someone within it. And if I tell it from the point of view of someone from my most developed nation, then that means they wouldn't have knowledge of the less developed nations, and those would get shorter entries, and thus I can get away with not knowing everything. So I might do that at some point, but it's going to take a lot of time if I go that way. On a more practical note, I find that word processors and Google Documents and things like that are enough for me. I do also use maps, which I make on Affinity Designer, which is, for those unaware, kind of like a mix of Adobe Illustrator and Photoshop, kind of put together in one package. I do recommend it. It's kind of just a general design tool, which I happen to be able to make use for maps. WonderDraft is also pretty good, but I kind of use that more casually. I find I can control the look of my Affinity maps a lot better. So I just use that for anything that I'm like seriously working on. So yeah, that's kind of where I organize things. And then it kind of gets added to over time as I'm interested in expanding on something or making a new reference document or working on the book. Something will come up like recently. I was editing a chapter and kind of thought to myself, oh, it'd be kind of cool if I added a little bit of lore to the religion in this spot. And then I wrote it in the book, and then I went to my world document and added it to that reference so I wouldn't forget it. But one day I would like to do some kind of world anvil thing like that world's guide as told from a character in the world. Something to share with people, but I'm just not there yet.
I definitely see the appeal, and I myself would like to one day make a world guide. And the idea of it being from someone's perspective in setting is just awesome. And
yeah, it lets you get away with not knowing shit.
Yeah. Having a different tone about different stuff, and it's such an easy way to retcon things later. No, he was just wrong.
Exactly. Or like he wasn't allowed to talk about it, you know?
That's actually how I write some articles on World Anvil as a unreliable narrator that pretends to be reliable. Just so I have an excuse to say, oh, but it's by this person. That's just a character in the world, so he could be wrong. Ooh.
And it's also just an interesting way to write stuff. Like, if you are this omniscient voice, you know, then people can take your word for what it is, and so be it. If it's a narrator from the world, though, like, ideally, you have a bit more character in that voice. You have them kind of wondering if what they're saying is true, maybe. You can just do a lot more with it, I think, than you can with an omniscient, you know, godly narrator. I mean, that's why we have, when we write our books or campaigns, it's all from the perspective of people in that world. It's not just like, here it is.
True. And on the subject of maps, the Wonder Draft is such a great tool, in my opinion. It's easy to use. People who don't make maps can make decent maps out of it. And it makes a nice map for you if you don't really have all the skills with Photoshop, which I personally don't. But I've seen the maps that other programs can make, definitely through Adam and a few other people, and they are sleek. So your choice in what you use depends, I think, on your skill level with those programs and your willingness to gain skill in them. But those are all my comments on what Adam had to say. Now, what do you have to say, Amakini?
Oh, I am very much in a similar boat as Adam. I do have a World Anvil account, and I've been using it sparsely in the past year. But for about the first 6 months after it released, I was actually really, really dedicated to my the campaign world I'm running in right now is actually on World Anvil. It has something like 60,000 words on there of just lore and recaps, things that happened and things I thought of. So I really like the tool, and it's very good for when I feel, and I don't want to be derogatory when I say this, when I kind of have, when I want to do some lazy world building in a sense, because it gives me all these prompts and it makes me think of facets of this world or of a city, of a person, of a creature, just details that I otherwise might not have touched on if I were just freeforming it myself. But when I'm not on World Anvil, I'm not trying to make a formal article that I'll usually link to my players or someone who's interested. I will, in fact, go to a word processor. At this point, I just use Microsoft Word because it's easiest for me. And I put in ideas as they come, as I think of them. And separate from my world building document, I have a campaign Bible that is, last I checked, is almost 370 pages long. And that's from, yes. It's a 2.5 year campaign so far. So it's just a lot of notes, a lot of bullet points. So I'd say actual content is maybe just 100 pages of campaign stuff. But yes, other than that, since I'm not an artist, I'm not really a map maker. I don't use many other tools. I've used map makers. I just don't think they're vital to my world building. I'm also not a very aesthetically minded person, although I can see the uses for them.
I need maps for my world building. Like, that's one of the first things I'll do when I'm working on a project, if it's new, or if I'm going to a new place in the world. I will, like, get some paper out and just start sketching what I think the place is going to look like, whether that's, like, the whole world or the region or a city. Just start kind of playing around with that, and then eventually it gets turned into, like, an actual map that I can share with people. And it's just really helpful because what I do with all my world building is basically I write stories. And if I send the story to someone for like a beta read or something, I want to be able to not make the concept of where the characters are located, anything that's difficult to get through, so that they have these resources and these maps. And it's also helpful for me to kind of judge distances and how long it should take to travel from A to B and all that good stuff.
I absolutely understand that. I'm actually a bit envious of people who can use maps and make them like themselves, and those maps be good. And Adam's made me a map before for one of my articles, so I know he's a great map maker. I think that in my regard, not only am I not great at at making them, mine are potato maps, as I call them. They work, but you don't want too many of them. But I think that trying to figure out the scale, the size, it's, although I know as a world builder, you're going to have to constantly adjust your world. It's one of those things that we can, when it comes to like really technical stuff like that, if I get too hung up, I might get too hung up on it, and then I won't be able to move on. So I try to just curb myself and say, don't do a map unless I've already detailed everything else. But that's me.
That's why all of my maps are from the world and thus unreliable.
Oh, geez.
This is the unreliable narrator episode, actually. Surprise. What about you, Dino? Are you still using World Anvil? I know you were on there for a while.
I was not on World Anvil. No, I have Legend Keeper, but I don't actually use it. A friend of mine gave me a link because he's in the beta, and I tried it out, but they didn't have the share mechanic when I had tried it, which they now do, and gets a recommend for me because that's the only thing that stopped me from using it. But I mostly use Google Drive, like making GDocs.
Yeah, I've seen those. I don't know why I thought you were using World Anvil.
Can you explain a bit what Legend Keeper is? Because I've heard of it, but I don't exactly know what it does.
It's an online browser program, I guess. Similar to World Anvil, you make entries like that are articles, and you can also have an interactive map where you can pin stuff, and then you can tie that pin to an article, and you can tie those articles to other articles, and there's a lot of fluidity to it all. And if you just mention something in an article in Legend Keeper, it'll tell you where else it is mentioned. Like, oh, I wrote about serpents in these six different articles, the serpents page will tell me where I mentioned serpents.
So it's kind of like a wiki page, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you can share certain pieces to people, like it's specifically meant for players, but you could use it for other things too.
RPG players, you mean, right?
Yes, RPG players.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's very cool. I think he's almost done with his beta, and it's a great product. So, but I honestly am too old fashioned for that. I barely have stuff on GDocs, and I have a foot tall pile of paper that I handwrite everything first and then put it onto Google Drive.
Oh wow!
Because I'm insane.
Yeah, I can't do that anymore. My paper notes are a jumbled mess. Like if you could see this thing, oof. It's like it's notes from my courses, as well as for this podcast today, as well as for another project I'm doing for fun. And there's no single orientation. Some of the writing is correct. Some of it's upside down. Some of it's at a diagonal.
Actually painful. Oh my God.
It's all done that way so I can kind of keep it separate so that they don't all blend together. It's kind of a, you know, hit and miss, but so far it's been working, sort of.
My paper taking days are over. They're behind me. I can't go back.
Yeah, it's so much harder to share that stuff. So like I'll take notes for later, but everything that I actually like take seriously is done online or on a word processor or something so I can share it later, save it, all that good stuff.
And I've filled about half a dozen notebooks this year. The distinction between us three.
The distinction between what?
The us three.
Yeah.
But yes, so those are tools. And what is so important about tools in a conversation about conversations? Well, simply put, you need these tools to show your work. It's fine enough to try to briefly explain something to someone, but if you don't have something to show them and it isn't just a brainstorming session, you're not really going to get anything across. And you're also going to need to record your world anyways. Recording your world is the basis of world building. If you don't record it, you'll forget it. and then you have no world. So these are just tools you need, modes to go about it, whether that's generating a foot of paper that is clear-cutting the Amazon, or a mix between that and online, or just online. It's the approach that you have with your tools that will be the way that you can show the world you are creating. So moving on from there, very simply, is just knowing your audience. And I don't mean who it's for, I mean who you're talking to. Knowing the person on the other side of the message board, the table, that, you know, gas station down the street, because you're just really lonely.
Oh, gosh.
But knowing your audience. So I guess the first thing that you have to realize is, have you had previous discussions, or are they starting fresh? Is this their first step into your world, or is this a trusted comrade you've spoken to many times, or someone you horrified by sending them a 50-plus page document full of races? The options are limitless. Approaching these people, it will always be different. And not just because all people are different, which they are, it's just you can't go into some heavy topic that's hyper-specific without them having the background that is built upon, if this is their first step into your setting. And they might need a little reminding if they've just dabbled in it. And even then, they may have trouble with it if they're a veteran of your world, depending on breadth and the focus of the subject at hand. Do you guys have any comments on that?
I mean, I think those are all good questions. I think one of the things that you touched on was, like, is this a new person? Is it someone who knows about your world? Most of the time, in my experience, it's going to be a brand new person that you're talking to, looking for some feedback. They pop in and, you know, want to talk with you about something, or, you know, you're trying to explain to someone what you've been working on this past year, et cetera. When you're explaining something about your world to a person, I kind of want to just reference back to the beginning of this discussion when I was talking about sort of what the seeing these Amish people on my drive today sort of brought to mind for me. When I told you about my world having this emerging technology, magic, I never told you what kind of magic. I referenced technology as it exists in our world, sort of turn of the century stuff. You know, that's because none of the specifics mattered to what I was trying to get across. I could have gone on and told you about the magic system probably for a good 10 minutes or so at least, because there are all of these nuances to it, different branches of magic, the way it interacts with water, and all of the different types of it. But again, I was just talking about the general perception of people, you know, more approving of magic. None of those specifics mattered. And when you're introducing someone to your world, like Dino kind of alluded to, I never found sending them a large document or breaking every little detail down for them ever was useful conversation in that first discussion. Once they've gotten into your world a little bit, then you can talk about that. You can answer their questions and such. But that's only after they understand it, really. Kind of what I've found to be one of the most useful things is figuring out what you want to say, what they need to know about that for it to make sense, and communicating that in a brief way so that, you know, number one, they aren't scared off by this giant wall of text, by this long monologue that you have, sort of like this one I'm doing now. Number two, you get the point across and you don't muddy it with other things that they get distracted by. Because if I'm telling you about how I wanted to make some separate sects within my world that were rejecting technology, were rejecting magic. If I told you about the like four different types of magic and its interaction with the world ahead of that, then your question isn't probably going to be about these different sects that I'm trying to create. It's going to be about the magic system, because I spent way more time talking about that.
It's true too. That is how it goes.
Yeah. So like you want to know what you want from the conversation and kind of guide that without being overbearing.
I agree. In general, it's like the focus of what your conversation is what people are going to ask about. I guess there is, I'm trying to think of how that kind of changes as you're going from sharing to feedback. Because like you said, if you as the world builder is focusing on the aspect, like in this case, not the magic system, you didn't mention it, so we weren't asking about it. But instead, you covered kind of the Amish part. So then that was the focus of the conversation.
So the idea that the focus of what you want your discussion to be about has to be the focus of what you're talking about, which sounds so weird and obvious, and yet so many people, myself included, fall into this time and time again, where you start talking about something, you go, wait, this, you don't have the context for this. I need another 50 minutes of talking to you about how this blueberry jam is made and why it's important. And
suddenly your audience is getting up to go get a drink and they don't come back.
Yeah.
I do want to add to all of this as well, because we are focusing a bit on people who are looking for feedback. And that's the kind of thing that I gravitate to, but not everyone is doing that. Sometimes people are just curious about what you're making and want to hear the elevator pitch, or you just want to share the elevator pitch. And in both examples, the constant there is being able to communicate generally what you're doing very quickly, because people are busy and they lose interest very quickly, just generally speaking. Even the most interested person in world building is going to lose interest in your world if you don't hit them with the twist or the exciting part of it pretty quickly, I think. So one thing that I think can help both with developing your world and with communicating it is being able to write in a very short space, maybe 2 to 3 sentences, one if you can manage it, what your elevator pitch for the world is. For example, and we've kind of referred to this already, but mine is turn of the century with magic. That's pretty much it. And there's a lot around that, and I can go into detail about it, but that's enough. I found that's enough for people to then start asking, oh, well, how does magic influence the 20th century? And so on.
I really like that you use elevator pitch, because I was thinking the exact same thing, is that when you're in a discussion with people and it's not really, let's say, I don't want to say marketed, but people don't always go into a conversation expecting someone to just go on about the world for, like you said, 50 minutes on blueberry jam. When you're sharing, there's almost like this unspoken etiquette that you're not there to do a presentation necessarily, unless you're specifically asked to, but rather that is sharing. You're giving an elevator pitch, and people, if it's something that really interests them, they might feel compelled to discuss further about, let's say, Adam's magic system.
Magic's Adam.
Adam's magic system. And so, because I love magic, I absolutely love magic. And when you said the magic system, like it has a different interaction with water, I just thought, I'd like to talk about that. That'd be something I'd ask about. Like, what do you mean by magic interacts differently or has different effects when it's like in contact with water? If I'm remembering correctly, I apologize if I got it wrong. And that'd be something that I as an audience might be compelled to hone in on because it appealed to my senses, not senses, to my interests, because probably your elevator pitch, which is maybe no more than 2 minutes given when you start talking about your world.
Oh, it should be definitely like within 60 seconds.
Yeah.
Like that's the ideal time for an elevator pitch. And that's true. That's a little bit of my sales background. I worked in sales for a few years here. And that was one of the things you have to communicate to your client, what you're trying to sell them, how it can benefit them, and get them asking questions about it all within like 30 to 60 seconds at the most, because they're busy. They don't want to spend money and they need to get about their day, whether or not they have something important to do because they don't want to talk to you. So, you know, it's the same thing with sharing your world. People are busy. They want to do their own things. They want to ask people about their world, as in the world they're making. And even though like it might be good for them to hear about what other people are doing, it's not the automatic thing that folks typically want to do. So you have to be short and concise and give them enough information for them to kind of be like, kind of like what you're saying here. Like, wait, You said magic interacts differently with water. What do you mean by different? So, you know, these are the kinds of things that we, I think, need to move toward to communicate better about our worlds and be more considerate and not take up as much people's time.
As a point to add to the ever-increasing list of things that I'm actually using from my American public schooling is the English class teaching of your hook. You have to hook in your reader. And if you're not doing it in the first paragraph, not in the first line, if you can't say to them, this is what we're talking about, it doesn't need to be all the information up front. It just needs to be enough for them to go, like Imakinate said, I actually want to discuss this. This is interesting to me.
And it needs to be clear. If you can communicate that quickly and also make it so there's no confusion, that is the best scenario.
I agree. I admit that that's something I kind of struggle with, and that's partly because
it's not easy.
It isn't at all. Not just like in real life, I struggle with an elevator pitch for myself, but in a world that's at this point just thousands and thousands of worlds, it does take kind of that, to an extent, taking interpersonal skills of figuring out what might this person be interested in. Like earlier mentioned, is that knowing the person that's listening to you, which is your audience at that time. It takes gauging. And I guess if more formally published works, that's what marketing is for. But when you're just doing one-on-one, it's not always easy to figure out what might click with someone.
Yeah, but you can kind of also kind of create these boxes for people where like I'm writing some things, so my audience are readers, and I've specifically engineered some things so that it's easy to jump into for people who aren't as familiar with fantasy. The main character in my story can use magic, but she doesn't use it a whole lot, and there's a lot of instances of her using it before like the end big battle where she like needs it, so that you kind of know what's happening even if you aren't as familiar with these sort of stories. Now in your case, as a person who's doing tabletop games, that's a totally different thing, because your players are going to want to know not just about the world, but okay, how is it different when I play in your world? You know, what things can I go do? So you tailor it to that as well.
Yeah, I found that the biggest thing I've been adjusting is magic in my world. And I've been adding mechanics that don't exist in basic 5e. And I've also had to kind of limit something from basic 5e because I thought that's not gonna fly with how my story is shaping up. I'm happy though that my players are very understanding and very responsive to my narrative and my world building, so I can do that. But I think that speaks more with their investment rather than necessarily my world building all the time.
Well, they're invested because of your world building,
or at least your storytelling, or because of audience members who don't have anything better to do.
But don't brag on the audience members. They're great because they can make a DM feel warm and fuzzy when people just really come to hear you for you.
Most of my players are audience members. I get it.
Well, I have a good mix. But yeah, one of them has been there since the very beginning, and they said that they will die before they get to not see my campaign end, which is kind of counterintuitive if you think about it, but that's what they said.
Bless their souls. Anyways, as we turn this into a D&D podcast with two people who run D&D and one person who never has. All right.
Hey.
You live. So,
when you're discussing things with other people about your world, there are always topics that you can bring up. They're evergreen. They're just things that like kind of everyone has or does or like knows a little bit about. Like almost tropes. And there's also the concept of like trading cool things, like, hey man, this is like something awesome in my world. And they go, oh dude, like this is something awesome in my world that's kind of like that. Oh my God. And you just kind of like meet in the middle discussing the cool thing that has brought you together. And so you have a couple avenues approach to engage someone in your world, especially for the first time. And I mean, in fantasy for me, and I know for a lot of other people, that fact can always be, what do you do about dragons? Like, everyone has a different approach. Everyone freaking has them. What is it in your setting that are different about the dragons? And even then just saying, oh, I don't have dragons, that automatically makes it different because everyone has dragons. I have dragons. I have too many dragons, and it's great. Adam is absolutely no fun and didn't even want elves.
I did end up including them.
I have dragons. It took a while.
It took like 5 years, but I did add elves. They're just dying out.
Loophole.
Yeah. it's an interesting story that I won't bore you with here, but I'm very, because I mentioned before how I'm
anti-elf, apparently.
I mentioned before how I'm trying to write things that people who aren't as familiar with fantasy can easily get into. That means having a human-centric story, because people can relate to humans.
Oh, very true. Look at Game of Thrones.
Yeah, exactly. So I've got some fantastical creatures here and there, basically rocks, these giant eagles, which can shapeshift into other birds. I don't know why they can do that. I don't know why I made them, but they're cool. So there's that. They're not a part of any of these stories, but they kind of make the world feel a little bit more fantastical, while not getting in the way of anyone reading who isn't as familiar with fantasy, because they're not a major part of the world. So I have a little bit of that going on, but that's why I didn't include elves for a long time, and why I have no dragons. So there's that.
I just want to point out that this is what I mean. By talking about something in your setting, say, hey man, dragons are cool. Oh wait, I don't have dragons, but I do this. Adam got to then talk about his world and things in it, things that are interesting. And I'm like, a shape-shifting, what? Oh my God, yes. That is awesome. To me, someone who's familiar with fantasy, I'm like, I want to see this. And people who aren't, we go, oh, that's kind of okay. But otherwise, they're not put off because it isn't a major part.
Shape-shifting eagles, they're kind of okay.
You heard it here first, people.
Exclusive. But yeah, no, I agree. Talking about the things that are more common, whether or not you have them, can lead to some interesting discussions, because everyone does them a little bit differently, ideally.
And at least for me, doing things different is a way to as well start a conversation, because of tropes and devices in both writing literature, RPGs, and world building in general. We have these common conceptions, and then it's easy to start and frame a conversation off of, well, my elves are kind of like elves, except here's how they're different, or here's how they're similar, or they're not at all like this. And you always have a jumping off point because they do exist, and being aware of them and being able to reference them is such an amazing tool when it comes to relaying your world building to other people and having that discussion.
Being able to reference the tropes, you mean?
Yes. Being able to reference the tropes and what devices you're using as a framework for the conversation.
Yeah. It's super helpful because, you know, humans are what they are. But even in describing that, the rock that I mentioned, I can use that trope of what a rock is. They're just giant eagles, basically, from fantasy. But they've got that little bit of a quirk to them, which I can tack on to that description very easily. They're very useful in both generating ideas and as well to kind of manipulate those ideas and see what they would be like if, you know, X was different.
Continue on with sharing your work. And when you're having these discussions, after you get through the initial parsing of back and forth of, oh, yes, this is what I'm doing. Oh, would you mind looking at this? There's kind of in my opinion, three ways to then approach this, mostly because just kind of stream of consciousness, writing in whatever it is, or just sitting there for 6 hours talking about it is not going to make any information sink in. You need something permanent. Mm-hmm. So the first way, the smallest way, is just a small detail doc, 1, 2, half a page, a paragraph, or maybe a World Anvil article that's small, just kind of, hey, look at this. What do you think? Can you give me some critique? Hey, my suggestions are on this G doc. Just throw them in there, out there. Just let me know.
One thing that some writers that I know use is what they call a cheat sheet, which is just usually a 1 to 3 page document that has the list of their characters, the general plot synopsis, and then a couple of other notes maybe that are relevant to what they're writing, so that if someone's jumping into chapter 10 because they need some feedback on it, then they can quickly look and see, you know, what they've missed, who the characters are, and so on. So something similar for your worlds, kind of like what you're saying, a synopsis of it, or like a single article that has all the information they need to know there, super helpful.
And it's such an easy way to get someone interested. And it does not have to be written amazingly, like you're a professional author who's famous, like, oh, this is perfect. Every word is used to 100% of its, you know, efficiency. It's okay. It can just be like sloppily thrown together and be like, hey man, like I don't know what's going on. I need some help. And that's where you get it. This is how you get it, is just by putting it out there and having it ready.
And the prose and grammar will improve over time. So, you know, that's just going to take some iteration and editing in its early stages. Notes, absolutely. You know, don't worry about presentation until late in the game.
I do think that it's kind of valid that not everyone would want to share a first draft. And I think that goes to the importance of making sure that you are in a safe creative space where people would give good constructive feedback, despite what a piece may lack or what a piece could work on. And I'm trying to relate this back to that stream of consciousness sort of writing, that there usually is a reason, and that's probably because of that initial draft stage where there is uncertainty and there is a lack of completion to a work that I think a creator tends to be more aware of than perhaps the people they're working on. And so that need for stream of consciousness while someone is listening may stem from a need to collaborate, need to brainstorm, and by having someone that's paying attention to your work, it can bring out what I like to think is that creative spark. Is when there's like eyes on you, there is that desire to create, and to create in a way that makes sense to you and hopefully will make sense to someone else. And that comes from explaining the process, which I think sometimes leads to just writing what comes to mind, stream of consciousness.
Sure. And in our the magazine's economic issue, I was able to speak with Dr. Trent Herdengrader. Herdengrader. It's a long name. I should have thought that through before saying it. sorry, Trent. but yeah, he's a super nice guy. I'd actually love to try to get him to come hang out with us one day. But long story short, he wrote this book about collaborative world building for writing and gaming. And it's really cool. I've skimmed through parts of it. I haven't gotten all the way through yet, unfortunately. But in our discussion, which you can read in that issue, he makes a comment about how collaborative world building is important because you literally could not create that whatever you're creating without another person there, because you've got different experiences, you've got different beliefs and ideas and knowledge, and only by combining them can you create whatever you did collaboratively. So yeah, I mean, kind of what we're saying here, very similar to that, where yes, a part of it is you can often feel more motivated if you're writing some world building for an audience like that, or for someone who's interested or who you're working with on it. I know Dino and I actually have dabbled a little bit in a collaborative project with a couple of other people, which is super fun. We got to get back to that at some point soon. But yeah, like we're creating stuff that I never would have thought of because there's like five of us who, mind you, are from all different parts of the world. So we've got totally different ideas about the way things could be and the way things could look. And it's just coming together in a way that, you know, I never would have been able to do on my own.
I think that sharing is perhaps the only way we can truly grow as creators. Our craft cannot improve if people don't see it. It's only ever the same, or at least it's can't improve as much, because it can always improve by you reading and learning and trying to internalize it. But without that outside opinion, how will you know that your approach couldn't improve even more? The fastest and best way, in my opinion, is to share. And I don't mean to share everything. I don't mean to just write 6 lines and throw it out there at the beginning of your craft. But sharing is how you grow. And it is an important part. It's worthy of dedicating a whole episode of this podcast to.
Sure.
Indeed.
Yep. And the way to really get people interested, not just to try to get them with the hook, but to send someone you know who knows your world, is an in-depth reading. This being something that is, you know, several pages long to a dozen or two pages, that has a lot to it and has a lot of contextual stuff that you have to have other information to get. It's something that is deeper in the lore, deeper with meaning, maybe is not specifically just written like an encyclopedia entry, but has some narrative prose to it. It's something that you're trying to tell a part of the world in a larger chunk with. And these are the pieces that really can help you grow the most when people read them and give you honest feedback on, or at least I like to think so.
Yeah, that is the goal. It's also important to mention, you comment that these could be larger pieces of work. Again, knowing our audience, though, like, some of the people who know about your world are going to be comfortable with those large documents, and other people either won't have the time or interest. So you kind of have to, again, know your audience here and send the right size documents and the right things to the right people.
I feel like that's directed at me.
No, not at all. I am just commenting on the things that you do.
For context, I've sent Adam, I think just two 250-page documents and one 30-page document, and I was like, hey, you want to read these? And it's just,
did I finish those? I feel like I might have, but I'm not sure.
It's in a haze.
I know I spent a couple days looking at one of them here and there when I could, but I don't know if I ever finished. I'm sorry if I didn't.
But this is perfect, because this gets into my third point on this, which is, no, seriously, Adam, I swear the monomyth is awesome. It's only 30 pages and written in an ecclesiastical style. It'll be a breeze. Or the sources we make that you can't expect anyone to read. At a certain point, it just becomes too dense, too long, too much. And even people, like one of my closest friends who is totally ingrained in my setting, my friend Alex, just, he like looked at it and went, this is going to take me a month. And it did, but he did finish it. And it's like, some of these things are just so dense that even the people who know and get the setting are going to have trouble with it, because it's just so long. Because when you look at something that's 30 pages, you just kind of like wipe the sweat from your brow and you're like, damn, this is going to be a couple hours or an hour, and I'm going to have to parse each piece and make comments and talk to you about it, and it's going to be a lot.
And if it's 30 pages with one or two foreign names in the first sentence.
or six, and the first sentence is nothing but foreign words, it's going to be hard, especially if you don't have an encyclopedia of terms on hand, which I definitely recommend making one. I've been yelled at enough where now I'm indoctrinated to think that this is a good idea. Thanks, Adam.
Got you, fam.
I feel for Dino. The moment he said 30 pages, I'm like, I started sweating. And
bless.
Yes. From my experience, I like, as a GM, I tell my players, you don't have to read my lore. I'll share with you what I want to share. But it took me a while to get to that point. I think, thankfully, and I think that's more for my self-confidence, some of them are interested in reading my lore and will read anything that I toss in front of their faces. Some of them are not as interested and I don't sweat it. But as I kind of got more experience with world building, I did, in thinking that people around me have limited time, I have limited time, I did begin to focus on things that interested them or were relevant to them, because that would be what most resonates with my audience at the time. And sometimes it gets longer and sometimes it doesn't. But like Dino said, credit to his friend who got through his entire document. An audience that really wants to read and is truly interested in what you're doing, your investment, will get through it. I think that we as writers and as creators are almost obligated to make it as I don't want to say painless, but that's the way I'm thinking of it right now, as enjoyable and respectful of their time as possible, to be formal in the wording of it.
painless as possible is just the perfect way to do it. And yes, a formal, like you just, you want it to be easy for them to read. You want to respect their time. You don't want something that's hard to digest that at the end, it's like, can you just explain this to me? And like, okay, yeah, I remember three of those 20 names. Okay, yeah, I'm getting it. And we all have that problem where we are the person who is the most excited about this setting. If you are not excited, the most excited person about your setting, you A, better be getting paid to make this setting, or B, like you need to make another setting, because you should be the one that's excited, who loves it the most, that it is in their care. It is you. It is a piece of you that you are putting on paper or on World Anvil or whatever tool you're using. You get the analogy, because it is your craft. This is your time, your energy, your thought. You should be the one who's most excited. But that does not translate into the 30-page document written in an ecclesiastical style that you're asking people to read.
Yeah, for those unaware, Dino just shared that with us. And a quick look, yeah, it's all there. I do love the titles, though. The Laments.
Thank you.
We do keep talking about kind of the written, the textual form of world building. But as you were talking, Dino, I was thinking, like, I kind of start to get why. So I feel like more than books, people just get really bent out of shape with television shows and movies and pretty much any kind of one of those performing arts, visual media that end up having really bad world building. Maybe, I don't know if it's just me, but I think that people really get bent out of shape more so than if they were reading a book. And I think that is because of what you said, and what has been talked about is time. Because compared to like reading, I feel like watching an entire season of a show or watching a movie is a lot more time investment or mandatory time investment than, let's say, reading a book at my own pace.
Agreed. And it is definitely why I likewise think that people get more bent out of shape about more visual mediums. And I think that has a lot to do with the expectation that the world building has to be organized and it has to be there and not just the attempt at being there. You have to actually, you know, put something into it, because that can help frame the show. And that's what the world building in those mediums does. It frames the show, and you have to understand it, and you have to pick it up at the snap of the fingers, because you have to be respecting their time and they want to know it as quickly as they can. They don't want to have to go back and like rewatch it 20 times just to understand that the kingdom of Callan is at war with the kingdom of Barsalvaan. Like, you just have to kind of show that it quickly with the world building. But that is pretty much all I have to say on sharing. Do you guys have anything else on specifically sharing?
I will add that in regards to visual media, the amount of time available is very much dictated by, you know, the number of episodes and the length of the episodes that the show has been allotted, or the length of the film. So where in a book you can kind of just like, you have more freedom to make the world building as involved or as little involved as you need for that story, because I feel like page counts are more flexible. Whereas like a TV show, it's going to be either like 24 minutes with commercials, or it's going to be like 45 minutes, or it's going to be like an hour long uninterrupted because it's on HBO or something. So you have to work around that as a writer. And that's how you end up with things like the Planet of Hats and all of these other kind of very simplified versions of world building, where they are trying to communicate an idea to you and they don't have a lot of time to do it. So they simplify it and shove it in your face and then move on. And I think that's where some of the frustration comes from, because, you know, good world building needs to be unfolded over time. And if you don't have that time to do it, and you know, like the Planet of Hats I mentioned, which comes from Star Trek originally, I believe, you know, they moved from location to location each episode. They had, you know, only one episode to develop each spot most of the time. So they didn't get to world build that place too much. So yeah, I mean, the medium 100% affects the kind of world building you can do. And sometimes it can lead to frustration, I think.
Similarly, personally, I feel like this is what's great about RPGs and running games like D&D is that you get the best of both worlds where you can have these bulk resources, like just massive lore dumps or small pages to supplement what's going on. And then as the story unfolds, you get to really slow burn out all of this lore and like different events that they didn't know and different lore pieces, and the world building takes on this form through what they're looking at and what they're going for. And it's probably my favorite part about being a DM, but that's just one of the benefits, in my opinion, of RPG world building.
I do agree. If I was a better artist, I'd actually start doing art for my world. I'm just not, because I can visualize it after I write it or while I'm writing it. And I just wish I could kind of take in or provide a more transmedium experience for my players. If I was more capable of doing so, I would.
Same. I wish I wasn't a good artist, so that way I could draw pictures. Like hunting down pictures on the internet to supplement your world building or RPG, it's like, oh man, okay, I guess I have to make it kind of fit instead of just making exactly what I'm thinking. But that just goes back to the idea of sharing.
I just wish I had more time in the day.
Well, listen here, Mr. Well-Rounded Skills.
I never claimed to be good at anything. I am exceedingly average at everything. Except for DMing. You guys got me beat there. I tried DMing once, not a good story. one of my players rolled a natural 20 and I lit the bar on fire.
All right. Before this turns into a D&D podcast, I guess we'll cover one last final topic, and that is giving and receiving critique. The basis here of giving and receiving critique is that there's essentially critiquing the work, being blunt, and then being nice versus kind. You know, critiquing the work, you go through it, you try to just parse the information, chew it up, and figure out what's there. And then how you relay it is it blunt? Is it this dichotomy of nice versus kind? Nice being you're just kind of trying to cover up like what's wrong with it, and kind is trying to frame it in a way that's as helpful as possible. What do you guys think?
So I wanted to talk about this specifically because I had heard of this critique feedback framework before, and I had to look it up again to double check and refresh myself. But there's a method of handling feedback called ASK, A-S-K, which breaks down into actionable, specific, and, as you mentioned, kind. Mercedes Bernard had a really good little blog or article about this from just last year, August 2018. And I would definitely recommend reading it. It's just a couple minutes to go through. And the long story short here is that she breaks down what that means, where basically you want to know the thing you're looking for in feedback, or if giving feedback, you want to provide something that they can work with, not just tell them how it makes them feel and force the person presenting to kind of parse out what that means. There's value to that for sure. It allows you to understand the audience members' thought about what you've shown them. And, you know, there's huge value to that in understanding their initial reactions. But one of the most helpful things is giving feedback, which you can prompt action with. If you can make that specific action, that's even better because, you know, I could read through Dino's 30-page document about his monomyth and tell him this was tough to read through because the names were hard. Okay, that's not super helpful. because he's probably not going to change his names. So if I instead were to say something like, you know, this one specific aspect didn't match up plot-wise, or I don't understand how it matches up, then that's something he can go and look at and say, oh, maybe it does, or maybe I need to make this more clear. So, you know, following feedback like that is just super helpful for both the presenter who is looking for that feedback and for the audience member, because it gets you thinking about the world in specific ways and sort of analyzing, well, why don't I like this? Why do I like this? Why am I confused? And, you know, in turn, that helps you develop your world so that when you present something, you go into it knowing how you reacted to what someone else showed you.
And choosing how you're going to approach it, like Adam said, is the key to giving critique. What do you think, Makane?
I had to kind of reflect on nice versus kind throughout all of that. I think that I would be a lot nicer as a kind of feedback giver if I was if I wasn't as knowledgeable of what has been presented to me, or depends all on the context of not only what is being presented to me, but my knowledge of it. Because if I were to give critique, speaking for myself, especially on world building, I want to give helpful critique. And that might not mean being nice. In some cases, that might not mean being kind. But first, I would need to understand what the creator, what the world builder, no matter what kind of content, honestly, was trying to go for. Because I think that has a lot to do with perceptions of quality, and perhaps, in my case, perceptions of fidelity to kind of either a process, kind of the, not exactly rules, but rather expectations for a work.
So kind of knowing your audience again.
Yes, it's circling back. Who knew?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Like, there are some people who I'll be talking with if they send me something. Like, I'll be a little bit more broad strokes with my feedback with them, because I know that's what they're looking for. They're looking for general ideas and reactions. And then there are other people who I know if they send me something, they're looking for exact details. So yeah, for sure, there's a definite element to that. I think, though, that either way, that ask method still holds up. It's just sort of the severity of that specificity piece of it that changes. Because you can be specific that this section of things confused you, or you can be specific that this piece of the succession of the section was confusing. The second example there is probably more useful, but the point stands. And one thing I want to add just about that whole nice versus kind thing, in the article that Mercedes wrote, she kind of defines them from her experience critiquing things. And without getting too much into it right now, she kind of separated them as nice being just looking for positive feedback. So even if you notice something was confusing or poorly done, like didn't make sense, whatever the case may be, you ignore that and you focus on the positive and just reinforce what they did do well. Whereas kind is, you'll talk about those things, but in a positive manner, and try to encourage improvement. All of that kind of being the opposite of rude or possibly even blunt feedback, where you're just saying, this isn't working, this is wrong, you know, those kinds of things.
Because I'm a damaged person, I like the blunt feedback. I think it gets to the point.
I like it too. I think it's honesty, and I like that. There's no obscurity to that. I think the other methods are good too, though. And again, you have to kind of know your audience.
I think blunt is fine. What's better is blunt and constructive. Because I think it's it's really easy to be just blunt and take that as being constructive, that the idea that they know the truth, so that it's being constructive. And I think that that's not always the case. Constructive is giving the reasons of why this isn't well, this isn't good writing, or this isn't good content, or this doesn't make sense because of X, Y reasons. And that's usually something that's kind of, I think when we ask for feedback, it's expected to get constructive feedback, but it's not always the case of that it is given.
Oh, definitely not always the case.
Yeah, unfortunately. And that just sort of brings us back to the whole ask stuff. You know, when you're talking to someone about their world and they're looking for feedback, tell them what you think, but, you know, be somewhat specific with it. Tell them what was a problem or what they did well, so that they can keep the things they did well and adjust the things that they didn't do. Simply saying that they liked it or that they didn't like it, you know, whichever positive or negative version of that, it doesn't do anything for the person who's looking for feedback.
And for me personally, when it comes to feedback, I always want to try to improve my work. So nice feedback, which tries to cover up improvement because it's just trying to talk about positives, only positives, I should say. It feels almost, it's antithetical to trying to advance your craft. And furthermore, it has this side effect on bluntness where people think that bluntness can only be mean, but you do usually have to say something nice like, I liked it. Oh, I thought this was cool. Because it assures them that what they read wasn't boring.
Blunt positivity.
Yep, exactly. Like you mentioned, like you need a side to the bluntness that isn't just this was wrong. I didn't understand this. And it's like, well, did you like it? Did you think this was cool?
I think kind of what we're getting at here is a discussion about the sandwich critique method. You start with something positive. You follow it up with something that they can improve on. And then you close with a positive statement. For some people, that can be really helpful. You know, again, like you're saying, reassure the person, the creator, that you liked what they did, and encourage them to continue working on it. But it gives them something to continue to develop and improve. So, again, kind of knowing your audience a little bit, I'm not the kind of person who would seek out that method of critique, but I can think of a couple people who would really benefit from it, because it would encourage them to continue, reinforce that what they've done isn't bad, and still give them something to go and develop some more.
Mm-hmm. It's good because it tells you something that's good. So then that is in itself a form of constructive criticism, because you know maybe you can focus on this, or rather you figure out your strength. Or you figure an aspect of the world that's really interesting, that's really strong, that you might want to expand on or put more focus on, because apparently this is what appeals. I like to think that if you're more on the I want to know how I can improve part, and that might mean getting the blunt force of what I did not do well, you can do the reverse sandwich, which is you start off with kind of, these are the things that I as someone that's giving you feedback and hopefully constructive criticism. I didn't get it, or I did not like it. This is what it is. This is the list. And then you say, but these things I really like, you list them. And then you go back to saying, and this is how I think you can improve those things that I didn't like from before, thinking back to what you did well. So it's like doing the sandwich, but it's just the opposite. And you kind of focus on the not as good things and end on it. And some creators might not appreciate that approach as much. Others will take it as a form of almost like a challenge, or rather just an assignment, because this is now what is not going as well in this otherwise possibly great work, something that I as a creator may want to improve on and really give it that touch that maybe someone else could have given me if I had not asked for feedback.
You made me think of a couple of things there. The first being when we're giving someone feedback, it's important, I think, to if you don't know, to ask what kind of feedback they would like. Unfortunately, a couple of times I've given feedback to someone and then they look at it and they're like, this is way more than I wanted. Like, this is just a fun project and you tore this apart. And I'm like, oh, sorry, I didn't know.
I feel that.
It's just super awkward. And like, I didn't mean to, like, I don't know if I made them feel bad or not, but if I did, I didn't mean to. And, just like genuinely trying to help, giving feedback on things that I thought could be made clearer or didn't make sense to me. And, you know, that just wasn't what they were looking for. So if you're not sure, it never hurts to just ask, what are you looking for in the feedback? And also, it's important to try and look at things objectively as well. I'm not going to, you use the word, like you would comment on things that you liked about a piece. That is incredibly valuable. It helps us understand the audience that what we're working on is for. But at the same time, sometimes you don't want feedback on what a individual liked or didn't like. You want to know, did the prose make sense? Was it easy to understand and follow? Was it exciting? There's, you know, obviously going to be some influence on your personal tastes, but if you can look at things objectively, sometimes that can be more helpful as well. So, you know, when needed, it might be required that you kind of separate yourself from your reactions.
Oh, yes.
Again, though, depending on what the person is looking for, because sometimes you just want, hey, what are your initial reactions? I want to know what you think. So again, just try and find out what kind of feedback that person wants.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Clarity and expectations and the critique process is key to having something that is constructive. And it's funny. Sorry, Adam, this isn't to rag on you, but when you were saying to look at things objectively, like how things are technically, and I'm just looking at my editing chair title. So I was like, I know what you mean, bud. I know what you mean. But yes, yeah. I can honestly say that I've been in a position where I could like something subjectively, but I have had, as it is my duty, to tell them it might not be technically up to snuff, or these are the things we need to work on because this is our criteria for the magazine. But that is specifically in that context within the magazine's style guides, within our standards. And even as kind of an informal critique, just someone showing a group of dedicated builders their work, that those criteria and those standards are important to establish early on. It keeps things constructive, it keeps it respectful, and hopefully in the end, the world builder, on top of receiving feedback on their work, will also feel kind of get that need for reciprocation. So then when someone else is asking for that kind of that ask for feedback to improve themselves, they too would know what they have felt or what they were going through in their shoes, and be able to give the same quality and same extent of aid as they received at some point.
Passing it forward.
Mm-hmm. And not to touch on it too much, but there is also the archetype of people who just aren't seeking critique, who just want to just share. And, you know, sometimes that's just fun to just listen to someone talk about their world. I just caution you to be aware when it does happen, under the guise of, hey, let's bounce ideas back and forth. Let's talk about our worlds together. And then it's only about them and they ignore what you say. Just keep it in mind that people can do this. It's not frequent, but it does happen. Just a PSA for all of you out there.
Yeah, that's something that's, at that point, that's sort of like setting expectations and then one person having an understanding of the expectations is different from another person. That falls down more, I think, towards an interpersonal, probably not an issue necessarily, but a misunderstanding rather, lack of a kind of not being on the same page about what it means to share or to discuss. And I don't think people should be hesitant to ask what they mean or to even ask questions just to gauge what exactly a person is looking for, even if the person that's sharing work isn't being direct in a way that maybe a possible critiquer or someone who gives feedback would understand. So having a conversation just on the meta of world building discussions before you dive into a work or listen to a work or be an audience member for someone who wants to share their work, that's very important for everyone involved.
Yeah, just in general, it's good to communicate your intentions as best as you can. If you do find yourself falling into that trap of wanting to bounce ideas around, but then only talking about your world and then suddenly having to go when you're done, try and be a little more mindful of that. And next time, let the other person speak first, and then you can go on when they're done.
The basis of sharing, it is respect. And a lot of what we've talked about is just trying to build up to the idea that you just have to respect each other, respect, as we said, time, what each other knows, what each other's willing to talk about. And at the end of the day, that's when you'll find people who will consistently want to read your setting, and they'll be able to parse bigger and bigger pieces. So I think we're going to wrap up here, and I guess we'll get some closing thoughts. We'll start with Immokinate first, unless she would like some time.
Oh, no, I got put on the spot. I really like this topic as we kind of got into the meat of it, because it shows a level of kind of interconnectivity between the different parts of the meta to world building. And this is the medium, how we present it, who we present it to, and the interactions between presenters and presentees.
Yeah, we really meandered, didn't we?
Mm-hmm. If there's anything that people really want to remember, is I think Dino just summed it up fantastically, is that it is a topic, a form of creative content that is centered around respect when it is brought to others and when you are reviewing the creations of others. I think that as creators, we all are connected by a sentiment that what we create is important to us. And I think deep down, maybe as a priority for some, a very important part of it is having that creation seen, accepted, and maybe loved is something that is we want to have for it. And some might be willing to take critiques, others not. And the basis thing, or rather, the most basic thing someone who is serving as audience member is to, I guess, try to understand while also maintaining the right to maintain their interest in only parts of a work and respecting what is desired if there is critique, and as well as respecting boundaries if that is not what was being looked for by the creator who's presented it. Sorry, I'm getting all technical. It's just to say it's all about respect, guys.
Yeah, totally. I think part of what you're getting at too is having empathy for your audience, and trying to write in a way so that they can digest it. And so like if you are like myself writing for readers, writing in a way so that they can take in the information over time and such. For tabletop games, take in that information as they play the game and optionally read extra material. So it's about knowing your audience and having empathy for them. It's about respecting others. And that can be done with how you organize your world. So something like World Anvil or Campfire or Legend Keeper is really nice because you can share these things and have it very presentable for someone. Or like even if you're just using a Word document, have like some nice big headers, maybe a table of contents if it's large enough, and present things in a way so that it's easy to follow. That's respecting their time and everything. And just communicate, be clear about what you're looking for. Ask other people what they're looking for if you're critiquing them. Or if there is no critique, and someone's just looking for feedback on if you liked it or not. At the end of the day, it comes down to those couple of things, and it's a lot. I know that, but it's important. And the more you do it, the easier it gets.
And to leave us with a Lord Dunsany quote, come with me, ladies and gentlemen, who are and wise and weary. Come with me and those that tire at all of the world we know, for we have new worlds here.
Here's your challenge for this week. Write the elevator pitch for your world.
You've been tuned into Worldcasting, an affiliate production of Worldbuilding Magazine. Have any feedback, comments, questions, or concerns? You can get in touch with us on our website, worldbuildingmagazine.com. There you can find links to our social media, or feel free to come chat with us on the Worldbuilding Magazine Discord server. Thanks for listening to Worldcasting, and until next week, keep worldbuilding.